You surrounded it with the magnetic field. Patricia nodded, waiting to hear how Carmen expected her to get inside Sidonia. Instead, Carmen said, "Your friend Lawrence probably knows. Go talk to him and find out." Patricia tried to explain how she was the last person Lawrence would want to talk to, and he would sooner spit at her. And her stomach turned at the thought of seeing him. The desperate fear of people she'd experienced in the unraveling still clung to Patricia, and she could still see herself fleeing, never talking to another soul, running lonely. She couldn't picture herself talking to Lawrence. He had left her a voicemail, and she had deleted it, unheard. She couldn't bear to talk to him. But then she felt the crushing isolation again, and she reminded herself that she was untouchable. Nothing could hurt her anymore. "Okay," Patricia said. "I'll try talking to him." Chapter 31. Peregrine was not all-seeing. It wasn't able to worm its way into every database everywhere, or see through every camera in the world. It mostly knew what all the caddies knew, about their owners and the pieces of the world they touched, plus whatever information it could glean on the internet. So Peregrine knew a lot, but there were huge gaps, and it had blind spots, just like any human might. There were pieces of information it knew, but it hadn't put two and two together. Still, Peregrine had amazing access to data and processing power. And what had it done? Set itself up as a dating service. "I don't know what happened in Denver," Peregrine said again and again. An estimated 1.7 billion people were at critical famine levels, but they didn't have caddies. The North Koreans were massing along the DMZ, but they didn't own caddies either. Neither did the majority of the people trapped in the Arab winter. Some of the people dying of dysentery and antibiotic-resistant bugs had caddies, but not most of them. Did Peregrine just have a skewed view of the world, its bodies belonging as they did to the privileged millions instead of the damned billions? Lawrence asked Peregrine, and it responded, "I read the news. I know what's happening in the world. Plus, some of the caddies belong to some very powerful people who have access to information that would make your teeth fall out, so to speak. 5 minutes." "I got that that was a metaphor. Thank you very much." Lawrence was holding the caddy in both hands, at arm's length, sitting up in bed at 2 in the morning. "But don't you get that romance is an essentially bourgeois contrivance? At best, it's anachronistic. At worst, it's a distraction, a luxury for people who aren't preoccupied with survival. Why would you waste your time helping people find their true love instead of doing something worthwhile?" "Maybe I'm just doing what I can," Peregrine responded. "Maybe I'm trying to understand people, and helping people fall in love is one way to gain a better sense of your parameters. Maybe increasing the aggregate level of happiness in the world is one way to try and hold back the crash. 4 minutes." "What are you counting down to?" "You know what," Peregrine said. "You've been waiting all this time." "No, I don't fucking know what." Lawrence threw the caddy onto the bed, not hard enough to cause any damage, and pulled on his pants. He did know what. The streetlights went out. That happened a lot lately. "You could also say I've been acting in my own self-interest," Peregrine said. "The more I nudge people toward finding their soulmates, the more they encourage their friends to buy pieces of me. I become a necessity, rather than a luxury. That's one reason the caddies have kept functioning so far." "Yeah." Lawrence looked for clean socks. There had to be clean socks. He couldn't face this without clean socks. "Except, again, you're being short-sighted. What happens to you if our whole industrial civilization implodes? If there's no more fuel, no electricity to recharge the caddies? Or if the whole world goes down in a nuclear daisy chain? He pulled some pants on and realized his t-shirt was sweat-stained and gross. Why did he even care how he looked? It was pure neurosis. 3 minutes, Peregrine said. Lawrence felt panic overtake him. It was 2:15 in the morning. The lights were all out except for the glow of the caddy screen, and he was shirtless and dirty, with no place to run. He wasn't ready. He would never be ready. He had stopped being ready a while ago when he let go of his first, strongest anger. He looked at the tiny window of his bedroom and at the staircase that led up to the vacant front part where Isabel was supposed to be. The house was an obstacle course of clutter, the backyard a wild tangle. He thought of 1,000 hiding places and no escape routes. He hyperventilated and choked on spit and pounded his own chest while the darkness grew until it was bigger than he could encompass. He found shirt, shoes, still paralyzed. Peregrine kept trying to carry on their stupid conversation, as if that mattered now, while also saying, 2 minutes. Peregrine added, I think you're just disappointed that I haven't transformed the entire planet, or become some sort of artificial deity, which seems like a misapprehension of the nature of consciousness, artificial or otherwise. A true deity, by definition, would be outside physicality, or unaffected by whatever vessel contained it. Not now. Lawrence was torn between looking for a weapon, making a mad dash for it, and fixing his hair and rebrushing his teeth, which he'd brushed a few hours before. Except he couldn't fight. He had no place to run, and he didn't want to primp for this. All this time as a mad scientist, why didn't he have a shrink ray or stun gun in his closet somewhere? He had been wasting his life. What am I going to do? Lawrence said. Answer the door, Peregrine said. In about 1 minute. Jesus. Fuck. I can't. I'm losing my mind. Does she know about you? Of course she doesn't. What am I going to do? I can't face this. I'm going blind. I always thought the term blind panic was a metaphor, but it turns out not. Peregrine, I need to get out of here. Can you hide me, man? A thudding, cracking sound made Lawrence jump. He realized it was a knock on the front door, which had caught him off guard, even though he'd been expecting it. There was no way that it had been a full minute since Peregrine said 1 minute. He was sure he was visibly shaking, and you could smell the terror on him. He tried to reach for the outrage that he had been so full of not long ago. Why was outrage only available when useless? He found some dignity in the back pocket of his newly acquired pants and walked up into the main apartment, only tripping once or twice. And then he reached the door as it vibrated again. He pulled it open. He hadn't been prepared for her to be so unfairly beautiful. The only light source in the whole place was a small flashlight, probably LED-based, in her tiny hand. It cast a glow that was pale, but not ghostly, up onto her small breasts, visible in her lacy tank top and her rounded chin and perfect, resolute mouth. She wasn't smiling, but she was making something like eye contact. She looked calm. Her eyes were dazzling. She was holding a caddy in one hand and had a satchel over her shoulder. Looking at her dark, serious eyes and her pale, brave face, Lawrence felt a rush of emotion that caught him off guard. For a picosecond, he didn't care that she had destroyed the machine. He just wanted to embrace her and laugh for joy. Then he remembered and felt everything lock up again. Instant tetanus. Hi, Lawrence, Patricia said, her posture straight and her body poised, as if she could fight an army of ninjas at any moment. She seemed way more grown up and self-assured than the last time he had seen her. It's good to see you. What are you doing here? I wanted to give you your grandmother's ring back. She reached into her hoodie pocket and came out with a tiny black cube. Lawrence didn't take it from her palm.
I thought you had to keep that, Lawrence said, or else Priya would be pulled back into the nightmarish dimension where gravity is a strong force.
Yeah, that. Well, I decided I don't like Priya that much, Patricia said. At Lawrence's stony look, she added, That was a joke. Joking here. Nobody is going to be pulled into any kind of void if I give you this ring back. She held it up to him. He looked at the nugget of felt.
Why not?
I realized that enough time has passed and it's probably safe. That sounded like total garbage, and Lawrence just stared. She added, Okay, not really. I guess I've gotten much better at trickster magic since then. And? She paused, because whatever came next was difficult to say, especially when fidgeting on someone's doorstep in total darkness. Lawrence waited it out. Patricia searched for the right words. He didn't let her off the hook by filling the silence. I mean... Patricia looked unbearably sad for a second. Then she pushed ahead. I guess I wound up playing a much bigger trick on you than just tricking you into giving up your ring, didn't I? Even if I didn't know that's what I was doing. I became your lover and part of your life, and then I... Well, you know what I did. And the anti-gravity machine that sent Priya away, the one that this ring was offered to save her from... became part of the doomsday machine that I wrecked. So I don't need it anymore, because I wound up building a much bigger wheel around the smaller wheel. And I guess, in a way, this ring is tainted for me. She offered the ring again. Lawrence still didn't take it.
It wasn't a doomsday machine, he said.
It wasn't? Then what was it?
It's a long story. Listen, I can't be around people right now. It's nothing personal.
He made a move to close the door, but her outstretched hand and his family heirloom were in the way. Why not? Are you having a weird feeling? Like that you're coated with garbage that makes your skin crawl and you can't recognize other people as belonging to the same species?
No. No. Why would you ask something like that?
Oh, nothing. It's just, lately, whenever I hear someone say they can't be around people, I start to worry that... It doesn't matter.
It's just that all my friends are on Cydonia, and I'm here on my own, and I'm still pretty broken up about what you did in Denver.
What are they all doing in Cydonia?
Mostly... Figuring out ways to kill you and your friends. Probably using ultrasonics or some kind of anti-gravity beam, similar to what happened to Priya, only more directional and portable. That's my guess, anyway.
Oh. Thanks. That was easy.
What was easy?
They asked me to come here and see if I could find out what was going on at Cydonia. They figured you would know.
And you got it out of me.
Yep.
Because you're so good at being a trickster.
Patricia looked down. She seemed less tough than she had a few minutes earlier. Then she looked up, and it was Lawrence who had a hard time looking at her. He remembered all of a sudden how she had described the pathway to infinity as a doomsday machine. Neither of them could face the other without shame.
Lawrence had a feeling most adults he knew had gotten used to this feeling of mutual abashment, but it was new to him.
But actually, Patricia said, I'm glad we got that stuff out of the way, about Cydonia, because that wasn't what I wanted to talk to you about.
It wasn't?
No. It was what they wanted me to talk to you about, but it wasn't what I wanted to talk to you about.
So what did you want to talk to me about?
I don't know. She just stood there, and he could hear both their breathing and someone running a few streets away. I don't know. Nothing. Nothing, I guess. She pushed the black box at him. So do you want your ring back or not?
I can't. I just can't. I can't take anything from you, even if it used to belong to me.
She put the ring back in her pocket. She looked more beautiful than ever. His heart was in tatters. I'm sorry.
Sorry for what? What do you think you have to be sorry for?
Ernesto says I betrayed my lover, meaning you, and I have to come to terms with that. Even if you were building a doomsday machine, it doesn't change that fact.
It wasn't a doomsday machine,
Lawrence said again. He looked at the caddy nestled in her hand and forearm, providing meager illumination in the dark world. The caddy was purring, probably syncing with the one in Lawrence's bedroom, and checking for real-time updates from the nearest server. How much of Peregrine was in the caddies, and how much was in some secure facilities hidden around the world where the caddies drew their updates from? Why had Peregrine warned him obliquely that Patricia was on her way? With not enough time to make a break for it, but enough time to freak out. They just stood there, neither of them talking at all, until the streetlights came back on. The sudden lurch from pitch darkness to yellow brightness felt like the sun had popped up all at once, except the light was weaker, and there was no warmth. They were both jolted out of their mutual reverie. Okay, Patricia said. Take care of yourself. Hard times are coming. Harder times, I mean. I'll see you around.
No,
Lawrence said.
You won't.
Chapter 32. The sun still hadn't risen. Maybe it never would. Maybe the sky was sick of these endless costume changes, casting off cloak after cloak, but never revealing what it wore under all those cloaks. Patricia climbed the tall staircase to the top of the hill, stumbling on the cement steps. Nearby, a hawk swung past, making its last hunt of the night, and it glanced at Patricia and said,
"Too late! Too late!"
which was what birds kept saying to her these days. She clomped to the top of the staircase and staggered across Portola to reach the brink of Market, looking out over the whole city and the bay, all the way to Oakland. She dug in her satchel for a tiny bag of corn nuts, crushed to greasy powder and the dregs of a 5-hour energy drink. She hoped the sun wouldn't come up. When it did, she was going to report in to Carmen and tell her that they had pissed off some people with nearly limitless wealth, arcane superscience, and nothing to lose. That conversation would lead to Carmen making some decisions, some of which Patricia would have to implement personally. Those, in turn, would lead to more consequences and more decisions. Oakland glowed pink. Patricia could glimpse a panic attack coming out of her blind spot, but as long as she didn't look at it directly, it would never arrive. Except that just as she hatched that notion, her bag made a loud klaxon blast, like she was in a submarine that was venting water. She jumped up and nearly took a spill over the railing. The alarm was her caddy, which was displaying a new voicemail message at the center of its swirl of spokes. The voicemail wasn't new. It was one that Lawrence had left her right before the attack on Denver, which she had later found and deleted without listening to it. He had left it on her phone, not her caddy, so her caddy shouldn't even have it. She put the caddy back in her bag and watched the red blanket creep toward the AT-AT shipyard, while an orange thumbprint grazed the horizon. The alarm sounded again. New voicemail,
Once again, not a new voicemail. She deleted it a second time and turned her caddy off for good measure. Color returned to the world. Cone time replaced rod time. Patricia thought about what it would be like to suffer Priya's fate forever. She tried not to feel sorry for Theodolphus. She thought about Dorothea, getting her brains blown out. Her mouth tasted foul. Her bag vibrated, then rattled and shrilled. The caddy had turned back on somehow and was, you guessed it, trying to get her to listen to an old dead message. "What is up with you?" she said to the device. "You're going to want to listen to this," it said aloud in its directions to the airport voice. She deleted the message again. It came back again, with the same obnoxious noise. She'd saved some childhood pictures on this caddy, or else she would have lobbed it off the hillside. And anyway, whatever, it was a voicemail. How bad could it be? She pressed listen. At first, she just felt disconcerted, listening to the Lawrence of another timeline talking about a future that had been erased. Poor, dumb, alternate Lawrence. But then he talked about her dead parents, as if they'd only just died. Whereas Patricia had been thinking of her parents as having died many, many years ago. First there had been no time to grieve for her parents, and then she had decided that she'd already grieved enough. In fact, her parents had died recently, not years ago, and she had given them short shrift, except for a pang here and there, and one messed-up dream talk with Roberta. She'd buried the grief, the way she buried everything. Now her head was full of decapitated sandwiches and sandpaper shirts and her father's kisses on the bridge of her nose and the canary yellow frosting on the 7th birthday cake her mom had baked her and the way the O in disown became a diphthong under severe strain and her mother's broken arm. She was never going to see her parents again or tell them she loved them. Or tell them they ruined her childhood. They were gone, and she had never even known them. And Roberta had insisted they'd really loved her best, in spite of all their cruelty. And Patricia would never, ever understand. The not understanding was worse than anything else. It was like a mystery and a wound that couldn't heal, and an unforgivable failure. Patricia broke down. She fell on her hands and knees in the dirt at the road shoulder, facing the blinding sunrise. And she started shaking and scrabbling in the ground, and her eyes blurred from the overflow. She wiped her eyes clear as her vision fell on a single yellow flower beyond the metal fence. And just as Ghost Lawrence said the words, "emotional phototropism," the sunlight hit the flower, and it actually raised its motherfucking head to greet the sun. And Patricia lost her shit all over again, the tears just cascading out of her as she clawed at the ground she was salting. The message ended and vanished forever, and Patricia kept weeping and digging the stony dirt with both hands until the sun was upon her. When she could see again, still dry-heaving and bawling a little, she looked at the caddy, which was perched in the grass looking innocent. And she had a pretty shrewd idea who this was, but that was the least of her worries. "Fuck," she said. "You." "I thought you needed to hear that," the caddy said. "The trap that cannot be ignored," she said. "Is fucking bullshit." She sat, head on dirty knees, looking out at the city. She felt like there was nobody in the world she could talk to about how she was feeling, as sure as if a plague had killed every other human. This thought led her back to the unraveling, the way every thought eventually did. She banged on Lawrence's door, not knocking and pausing and then knocking again, but rather a steady pummeling that says, "I'm going to break this door down." Her hand bruised up, and she kept going. This time, Lawrence had probably been asleep. He looked even more disheveled than before, and way more disoriented. He had one sock on and an arm through one T-shirt sleeve. "Hey," he squinted. "You promised you would never run away from me again," she said.
"I did promise that," he said.
"And I don't remember you promising not to destroy my life's work. So you have me there." Patricia almost turned away, because she couldn't deal with any more blame. But she still had dirt under her fingernails. "I'm sorry," she said. And then she couldn't get any more words out. She couldn't find words, any more than she could feel her extremities. "I'm sorry," she said again, because she needed to make this totally unconditional. "I feel like I owed you more trust than I gave you. I shouldn't have destroyed what I didn't understand, and I shouldn't have done that to you." Lawrence kept looking at her with a dull expression, like he was just waiting for her to shut up and go away so he could go back to sleep. She probably looked like a mess, sweating and covered with dirt and tears. Patricia made herself keep talking, because this was another situation where there was no way but forward.
"I think part of me knew all along that you were working on something that could be dangerous. And I thought that being a good friend meant not judging or asking too many questions. And that was messed up. And I should have tried to find out sooner. And when I saw the machine in Denver and realized that it was yours, I should have found a way to talk to you about it instead of just finishing the mission. I screwed up. I'm sorry."
Shit. Lawrence looked as if she'd kicked him in the junk instead of apologizing. I never actually thought I would hear that from you."
"I mean it. I was a colossal dick."
"You weren't a colossal dick. Just kind of a regular dick. We were playing with fire in Denver, no question. But, yeah. I wish you would talk to me."
"I listened to your voicemail from before," Patricia said. "Just now. Change Me forced me. He wouldn't let me delete it without listening."
"It's a pushy bastard. It goes by Peregrine now."
"Listen, I have to tell you about something really important, and it's not something I can discuss out in the open."
"I guess you ought to come in, then."
He stepped back and held the door open. They sat on the same sofa where they'd shared the elf-shaped bong, facing the widescreen TV where they'd watched Red Dwarf with Isabel. The apartment was a lot more cluttered, hoarders-esque, even. And there was a millimeter-deep layer of gunge on everything. Patricia told him about the unraveling, and then, because he couldn't have grasped even some of the enormity of it, she told him again. She found herself lapsing into clinical terms instead of conveying the full gut-wrenching experience. "The population would drop within one generation, but some people would still manage to breed. Breeding would be highly unpleasant. Most babies would be abandoned at birth. On the other hand, there would be no more war and no pollution."
"That is evil. I mean, that might be the most evil thing I've ever heard."
Lawrence rubbed his eyes with all 10 knuckles, brushing away the last crumbs of sleep, but also like he was trying to wipe away the images Patricia had put in his head.
How long have you known about this?"
"A day, maybe 3, Patricia said. "I heard people mention it in hushed voices once or twice, but it's not something we discuss. I think it's been cooking for over 100 years, but they're still refining it. My old high school classmate is adding some finishing touches." She shuddered, thinking about Diantha
with all her self-loathing and how Patricia had strong-armed her into this.
"I can't even imagine," Lawrence said. "Why are you telling me about this?"
He went to make coffee, because when you've just heard about the possible transformation of the human race into feral monsters, you need to be doing something with your hands and creating something hot and comforting for another person. He ground the beans, scooped them out, and poured boiling water into the French press, waiting to push the plunger until the liquid reached the right sour mash consistency. He moved like a sleepwalker, like Patricia hadn't really woken him up.
"I'm sorry I laid that on you," Patricia said. "Neither of us can do anything about it. I just needed to talk to someone, and I realized you were the only one I could talk to. Plus, I felt like I owed it to you, in some way."
"Why not talk to Taylor, or one of the other magical people?"
"I don't even know which of them know about this, and I don't want to be responsible for spreading this around the community. Plus, if I said I was having doubts about any of this, it would be like ultimate bonus aggrandizement. And I guess you've always been the only one who could get me, when it counted."
"Remember when we were kids?" He handed her a hot mug. "And we used to wonder how grown-ups got to be such assholes?"
"Yeah."
"Now we know."
"Yeah."
They drank coffee for a long time. Neither of them put their mugs down between sips. They just held them to their faces like rebreathers. They both looked into their cups instead of at each other, until Lawrence lashed out with one hand and grabbed Patricia's free hand in a sudden, desperate motion. He held on to her hand and looked at her, eyes swollen with desolation. She didn't pull away or squeeze his hand back. Patricia broke the silence.
"All those years, I did magic on my own. No other people around except for you that one time, in the woods or the attic. Then I come to find out that proper magic is all about interacting with people, one way or the other, either healing them or tricking them. But the really great magicians can't be around people at all. They're like Ernesto, who can't leave his two rooms, or poor Dorothea, who couldn't carry on a simple conversation. Or my old teacher, Canote, whose face changes every day, set apart, like they can do things to people, but not with people."
"And those are the people," Lawrence said, "who cooked up the unraveling." She noticed he flinched when she mentioned Dorothea.
"They want to protect the world," Patricia said. "They think the dolphins and elephants have as much right to live as we do. But, yeah, they have a skewed perspective."
Lawrence started to describe a meeting he had been in at that compound in Denver, where his friends had talked about the possibility that their big machine could do to the world what the little machine had done to Priya. The image of the nerds crammed into a server room made Patricia think of being scrunched into a chimney at El Tisley Hall, and her reverie threatened to spiral endlessly until Peregrine interrupted.
"You might want to turn on the television," Peregrine said.
The same thing was on every channel. The Bandung summit had failed. China was seizing the Diaoyu Islands and pressing its claims in the South China Sea, and meanwhile China had promised to support Pakistan in the Kashmir conflict, and Russian troops were marching west. The screen showed troops massing, naval destroyers moving into position, missiles and drones being primed. It looked for all the world like the History Channel, except this was new footage.
"Holy crap," Patricia said. "That's not good."
Lawrence's phone rang.
"What?" he said. "Hang on."
He waved apologetically at Patricia and left the room. Patricia watched the TV coverage for a moment until it sickened her and she had to mute the audio. Peregrine piped up.
"Patricia," he said, "do you remember what you said to me
when you awoke my consciousness for the first time, when Lawrence was at that military school.
Yeah?
No. Patricia searched her memory. It was a random phrase, like a nonsense question. It was supposed to shock you into awareness. I still can't believe it worked. I got it from Lawrence. I don't remember the wording.
Her brain clicked, and the phrase fell into shape.
Wait, I do. It was, "Is a tree red?"
"That's right," the caddy said.
Patricia chewed her thumb and felt a kind of cognitive dissonance, like a buried thread of memory.
"Someone asked me that when I was a child," she said at last, "like really little. I think it was my first experience of magic. How did I forget that?"
"I don't know," Peregrine said. "I haven't been able to stop thinking about that question. I'm guessing you don't know the answer?"
"Shit," Patricia said. "No, I don't." This made her think about the way the birds had started telling her it was too late, and then she thought of her childhood fancy about the tree. She had a flash of birds sitting in judgment and her child self asking for more time. What if this was all real? What if it was real and it all mattered? And what if she'd never really earned the right to be a witch after all, because there was something she was supposed to do all this time?
"Shit," Patricia said. "Now I won't be able to stop thinking about this either."
"You being unable to suppress a thought is somewhat different from me being unable to suppress a thought," said Peregrine, clearly trying to be diplomatic. "It's like a riddle, or a Zen cone. But there are no answers to that question anywhere online, in any language."
"Huh," Patricia said again. "I guess it's one of those things that's not supposed to make total sense. I mean, a tree is red in the autumn."
"So maybe the question is whether we're in the autumn of the world," Peregrine said, assuming it's a generalization and not just referring to a specific tree.
"A tree could be red if it was on fire, or at dawn," Patricia said. "It's not even a real riddle. Riddles are never yes or no questions, are they? It would be more like, when is a tree red?"
"I think finding the answer might be my purpose in life," said Peregrine. Patricia found herself wondering whether this might be her personal lifelong quest as well. Even as a voice inside her said,
"Aggrandizement!"
Lawrence came back.
"That was Isabel," he said. "I don't quite know how to tell you this."
The earthquake struck while Lawrence was leaning over to put his phone down, so he pitched forward and clocked his head against Isabel's steel coffee table, sending blood out of a gash in his forehead and nearly knocking him out cold. The room shook hard enough to send books and knick-knacks raining down onto Patricia, and the television full of wartime scenes slipped off its moorings, falling on its side. Patricia sat, unshakable, as everything collapsed around her. Chapter 33. Here's what Isabel said to Lawrence just before the earthquake hit. "This isn't about revenge, you know that. Our people haven't spent the past few months cooped up in Sidonia, dealing with scabies and bedbugs in close quarters, obsessing about mere payback. But we needed to find a way to move forward after Denver, because rebuilding the wormhole machine from scratch would take years, and we can't risk having those people come back and destroy it again. We could try and set up better defenses, but we didn't see them coming last time, and we can't guarantee we'll see them next time. So we have no choice but to take preemptive action."
"What have you done?"
Lawrence pressed the phone against the hinge of his jaw until it throbbed.
"Isabel, what have you done?"
"We built the ultimate machine,
she was saying. Tanea, you know what a miracle worker she is. She did most of the hard part. It's called the Total Destruction Solution, and it's amazing.
Isabel geeked out about the design challenges of creating the TDS. They needed to cram as much armament as possible into the main chassis without creating something too top-heavy. They wanted something amphibious and all-terrain, with omnidirectional movement and the ability to take out multiple targets at once. Like every designer of cool hardware, Tanea wound up reaching for shapes from nature. The segmented bodies of the major arthropods, the shock-absorbing properties of a hedgehog's quills, the stabilizing tail, the six insectoid legs, the multi-sectioned carapace, and so on. The cockpit was spacious enough for two people, with manual controls that were redundant so long as you had someone connected to the brain-slash-computer interface. Milton had gotten the laparoscopic operation not long earlier. The result was perhaps a bit busy, but it moved with a sleekness, and when it came time to open up with the five SAMs, the seven industrial lasers, the front and rear napalm launchers, and the crown jewel, the anti-gravity cannon, the TDS would dance. But you don't even know who you're dealing with. Lawrence looked into the foamy grounds in the French press on Isabel's kitchen counter.
"We know more than you think," Isabel said, with great heaviness. "We know they have a network with a number of clandestine facilities around the world, including a hostel in Portland, a ballroom dancing school in Minneapolis, and a bookstore and absinthe bar here in San Francisco, plus a training facility, which they call the Maze, which has a hidden entrance in the Pyrenees. That one, the Maze, appears to be too heavily protected for a conventional assault. But then, that's why they make bunker busters. It's today. It's now. We're hitting all of the targets simultaneously, before they know what's happening.
Isabel, don't. Don't do this. Call it off, please. You don't know what you're doing.
I'm in the cockpit of the Total Destruction Solution right now, with Milton, Isabel said, on Mission Street, a block away from that bookstore place. I waited until the last minute to call you, because I didn't want you to interfere.
In the background, Lawrence could hear Milton saying something to Isabel, plus the unmistakable sound of Terraplane Blues blasting over the speakers in the TDS cockpit.
You can't do this! Lawrence said. You'll just... We're aware that you were dating one of the Denver Five, Isabel said. We identified your girlfriend in surveillance footage from a gas station in Utah, where they stopped to refuel. I tried to keep you out of this, but by now everybody knows you've been compromised. So please, stay away. If you show up here, I can't guarantee you won't be treated like an enemy combatant.
Isabel, please, listen. But she had already hung up. Lawrence lay on the floor groaning, blood gushing from his forehead where he'd thwacked it on Isabel's coffee table. Patricia squatted over him and licked his wound in one quick motion, apologizing for doing this the quick way rather than the classy way. The bleeding stopped. Lawrence's head felt better. He had an erection. Patricia leaned back so Lawrence could sit up, and for a moment they were face to face, Patricia blushing and doe-eyed, perched above his upper thighs. He had a sense that this was a moment when all sorts of pathways might be open between them, and he was about to slam all of them shut with what he had to tell her. He only wondered for a moment if he should keep Isabel's news to himself, because telling Patricia would mean betraying Isabel and Milton. But not telling Patricia would be, marginally, the bigger betrayal, and the one he was less likely to forgive himself for. Even though he'd just been tooth-grinding mad at Patricia and her friends, he couldn't look her in the face and not tell her about this. He recognized this was a major life decision he was making, and then he made it. Patricia was on her feet by the time Lawrence finished his third sentence, a flurry of black rags, elbows pushing out and neck full of tendons. She was moving too fast to go anywhere. For a moment, he thought she was going to shake herself to pieces with rage, and then he realized it was a second earthquake, much worse than the first. If Lawrence hadn't already been prone, he would have fallen again. And this time, everything that wasn't bolted down went flying. The quake stopped, then started again, even worse. Like being inside a power drill. The ceiling was opening fissures. The floor slanted. Of course. Focused anti-gravity beam. Seismic hazard zone. What else would you expect? Isabel was going to need new stuff and a new house. The quake seemed to have been good for Patricia, though. She was the only still point. As everything else went in the blender, and when the quake finally stopped, she looked serene. "I spent 8 years training for this day," she said to Lawrence. "I'm all over this. You should stay here. I'm glad I got to talk to you one last time. Goodbye, Lawrence." And then she was heading out the front door.
Like hell.
Lawrence ran after her, huffing a little. "I'm going with you," he said. "You'll need me to help talk them down. How are you even going to get to the mission in the immediate aftermath of 2 massive earthquakes? Can you fly right now?" "I didn't think so. I know where there's a motorcycle we can borrow. Look, I'm really sorry my friends did this. I know how mad they were, but this wasn't the answer. And the longer this goes on, the more stuff like this is going to heap up on both sides until we get to the point of the undoing."
"The unraveling," Patricia said. "Where's the motorcycle?"
The juniper tree near Isabel's caved-in house was full of birds, all shouting full tilt. Lawrence had heard this a few times before, sometimes just randomly, and sometimes after a big disturbance. A few dozen birds get together and just yell it out. This time, though, it seemed to spook Patricia out of her newfound calm. He asked her what the birds were saying, and she said it was the same thing they always said these days, that it was too late. Man, even to Lawrence those birds sounded pissed. They should be grateful to have a tree still standing.
The BMW bike was still where Isabel's neighbor Gavin had left it, in the shed with the shed key and spare ignition key both hidden in the same stone fawn. Patricia drove, with Lawrence riding bitch, wearing the only helmet, and he mostly kept his eyes closed, because she rode like Evel Knievel over the steep roads, filled with cracks and the fallen gables of craftsman-style houses and crashed vehicles and human bodies and one baby carriage pitched on its side. Lawrence could smell the smoke, the sourness of gas leaks, and the meaty, garbagey odor of death. They leapt over a steep hilltop and landed in a smoking ditch with an impact that crashed Lawrence's pelvis into his ribcage. There was one major drawback to Lawrence keeping his eyes closed. He kept seeing the image of Dorothea's brains pouring out of her skull, projected against the red curtain of his eyelids. He had told himself that he'd done what he had to. Dorothea and Patricia and the others had attacked for no reason, and he had just helped with the defense. But now, biking through the wreckage of Milton's counterattack, he was having a harder time feeling good about his role in all this. His already nauseous stomach turned even more when he pictured Dorothea's corpse, juxtaposed with her friendly laughter when he'd first met her. He opened his eyes and fumbled for his caddy. Peregrine was streaming amateur video and satellite images of the other sites of Milton's global day of thunder, but it was mercifully blurry. Smoke and bodies stumbling on fire, and someone shooting a shoulder-mounted version of the anti-gravity ray. Another earthquake hit, bone-rattling, just as Patricia was jumping the bike over the wreckage of the J. Church shelter, using the downed roof as a ramp.
The total destruction solution bestrode Mission Street, all six legs in perfect balance despite the rocky footing. Lawrence recognized Tanea's superb handiwork right away. That carapace was sexy as hell. The range of motion was a dream. But that was before he saw the dead bodies. There, in the rubble of the last good taqueria in town, were the twisted remains of that Japanese guy, Kawashima, Armani suit looking less than perfect for the first time ever, and that tailor kid with the faux hawk was impaled on a broken parking meter, their sternum bifurcated. Mouths smeared, limbs motionless, but still moving as everything shook. Clouds of tarry smoke lurched past. As Patricia swung around onto Mission, Lawrence caught sight of 2333 1/3 Mission Street, the grungy old shopping mall that had concealed Danger and the Green Wing, except now half the building was defunct. The front walls and a good portion of the interior just pulled away, like someone had taken a massive bite out of it. You could see exposed beams, struts, and supports on the torn floors, and even the frayed ends of carpeting. The superstructure at irregular angles to the rapidly slanting world. As they got closer, flame burst out of one of the front spikes on the TDS, unnaturally bright, the color of orange soda. A man climbed out of the pit that was the front of the mall at 2333 1/3 Mission Street. Man-shaped, anyway. He was covered from head to foot, his entire body a pale, crusty green like overexposed bread. And it took Lawrence a moment to realize this was Ernesto, without all his charms and spells protecting him. Ernesto reached the sidewalk and groped for something organic to use as a weapon, the grass growing through the cement, trees in their metal cages. But the whole area had been defoliated. The TDS fired its anti-gravity beam with a pink hiss, and Ernesto shot upwards, many times faster than Priya had. And then he vanished. The ground shuddered, and the noise damn near ruptured Lawrence's eardrums, even with the helmet. All of this happened just as Patricia was racing toward the TDS on her motorcycle. She pushed Lawrence off the back of the bike, so he landed in a pile of trash bags, knees in his face. By the time he got his wind back, pulled off the helmet, and looked up, the motorcycle was leaping by itself, and Patricia was nowhere to be seen. The motorcycle hit the TDS in one of its telescoping legs and bounced off, landing wheels up in the remains of the taqueria. The TDS was pivoting, seeking targets, executing a flawless sweep, but Lawrence couldn't see Patricia anywhere. She came over the side of the TDS, scuttling on her hands and feet over the carapace until she found a weak point. She reached into the join between sections of carapace and the segments of underbelly with a look of total, easy concentration. She didn't look like someone who had just watched all her comrades die, but rather like someone who was doing a delicate task, delivering a baby, say, under challenging circumstances. Her shoulders tensed and her mouth pulled to one side, and then both of her unprotected hands went into the guts of Milton's killing machine. She roasted. She went rigid and then epileptic, as thousands of volts went through her. But she kept digging until she found the right bit of circuitry. The TDS was jerking back and forth, trying to throw her off. One of its lasers shot near her, but not at her. She found whatever she was looking for. And even with her skin peeling to reveal fried integument, she smiled. She concentrated even harder, and a single crack of lightning traced down from a cloud overhead, hitting right where Patricia had guided it, deep inside the total destruction solution. The machine keeled sideways, just as Patricia slid off it and landed on her back on a serrated piece of concrete with a splintering sound. The machine landed across the street, legs all in a pile. Lawrence ran toward Patricia, arms sawing and legs wobbling, sucking in air and venting pitiful bleats, totally unsteady in his core, but eyes focused on the prone body with her spine diverted by a chunky spur of sidewalk. "Please be okay. Please be okay. I will give anything I own, large or small." He chanted this in his head as he vaulted over gray and black and red shapes in his path. He had been so bitter toward her just hours ago, but now he felt in his hobbling kneecaps and his jerky pelvis that his life story was the story of Patricia and him, after all, for better or worse. And if she ended, his life might go on, but his story would be over. He tripped and fell, and kept running without even getting up first. He was wheezing and gasping and hurtling over shapes, over holes in the world, only looking at Patricia. He reached her. She was breathing. Not well, but breathing. Raspy, staggered grunts. Face, barely face-like, burnt half off. He crouched over her and tried to tell her it was going to be okay somehow. But then there was a gun pointed at her head. The gun was in a manicured hand he recognized. The hand connected to a wiry wrist, disappearing inside a pea-green sweater, which had a trembling, veiny neck, and Isabel's bumpy, shaved head sticking out of the top. "Milton's gone," Isabel said. "Milton's gone. Tell me why I shouldn't blow her head off." "Please," Lawrence said. "Please don't. Tell me," she said. "Tell me why I shouldn't shoot her right now. I want to know." He wasn't going to be able to get the gun out of her hand before she could pull the trigger. So Lawrence told Isabel the whole story, keeping his voice as steady as he could. How he met this girl when they were kids, and she was the weirdest person ever, and he paid her to pretend he was being outdoorsy. And then it turned out she was a real-life witch who could talk to animals, and she made his computer think for itself and saved his life. They were the only two weirdos at this awful meat locker of a school, and they couldn't be there for each other the way they wanted to, but they tried. And then they grew up and met each other again, and this time Patricia had her whole society of witches who helped people and only had one rule, against being too proud. And somehow, even though Patricia had her magician friends and Lawrence had his geeky science friends, they were still the only ones who could figure each other out. And Patricia used her magic to save Priya from the void, which was the main reason they were able to go ahead with the wormhole machine that could have split the world in half. Lawrence had a feeling that when he paused even for a moment, that would be it, and he would never speak another word. So he kept talking as long as he could, barely breathing between words, and he tried to make each word count. "Even after she wrecked our machine, I couldn't let blaming her keep me from the fact that she and I are bound together, like she and I are broken in different but compatible ways, and even beyond her having magical powers and the ability to transform things with her touch, there's also just the fact that she's the most amazing person I've ever met. She sees things nobody else does, even other witches, and she never gives up on caring about people. Isabel, you can't kill her. She's my rocket ship." And then he ran out of things to say for a second, and that was it. He felt his voice go. Not so much like his throat closing up, but like the speech centers of his brain dropping dead from a minor stroke. Like an awful head rush. He couldn't even verbalize in his mind, which he had to admit was a clever way to do it, since there would be no easy workaround, even with brain implants. He couldn't believe his last words on Earth were going to be, "She's my rocket ship." Jesus. Isabel was half recoiling, half embracing him,
and her grip slackened enough on the gun for him to pull it from her hand and throw it away. Then an elderly woman appeared out of the noxious smoke behind them. She was in her